Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you an hour of news, history, information, and commentary about the African American community. Today's program has readings from The Hill Newsletter, The New York Times. I'll wrap up the program with an essay that appeared in The Atlantic Magazine, and I'm starting with two readings that were in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. My next story is part of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's February 2024 Black History Month series that focuses on the role of the arts in the Black community. The title is The Complicated Legacy of Oscar Winner Hattie McDaniel. It was written by Ernie Suggs and Arlinda Brody and published February 6, 2024. When Hattie McDaniel was dying of cancer in 1952, she made a special request. She wanted the Oscar she won for Best Supporting Actress for her role as Mammy in 1939's Gone with the Wind to go to Howard University. It was there until the late 1960s or early 1970s when it mysteriously went missing. Was it thrown away? Misplaced? Stolen during a period of student unrest? In October 2023, representatives from the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences presented Howard with a replacement Oscar for McDaniel. "It was as if she was there with us," said Felicia Rashad, the dean of the university's Chadwick A. Boseman College of Fine Arts. Since her groundbreaking performance that made her the first Black person to be nominated for and win an Oscar, McDaniel's legacy has been profound and complicated. Some critics called her character the only sensible and likable person in the entire epic film, but the accolades didn't bring about star treatment. An article in The Hollywood Reporter recalled the evening. McDaniel arrived for the 12th Academy Awards, held at the famed Coconut Grove nightclub in the Ambassador Hotel, in a rhinestone-studded turquoise gown with white gardenias in her hair. She was escorted not to the Gone with the Wind table, where producer David O. Selznick sat with Olivia de Havilland, who was the other supporting actress nominee, and his two Oscar-nominated leads, Vivian Leigh and Clark Gable, but to a small table set against a far wall, where she took a seat with her escort, F.P. Yoger, and her white agent, William Micklejohn. With the hotel's strict no blacks policy, Selznick had to call in a special favor just to have McDaniel allowed into the building. McDaniel was born on June 10, 1895, in Wichita, Kansas, to former enslaved people. She left school in 1910 to become a performer in a traveling minstrel group. During the Great Depression, there was little work to be found for minstrel or vaudeville players, so she took a job as a bathroom attendant at Sam Pick's Suburban Inn in Milwaukee. Although the club, as a rule, hired only white performers, some of its patrons became aware of McDaniel's vocal talents and encouraged the owner to make an exception. McDaniel performed at the club for more than a year until she left for Los Angeles, where she found a small role on a local radio show, The Optimistic Donuts. Known as Hi-Hat Hattie, she became the show's main attraction. Movies came next, but she was constantly relegated to servant-type roles. During the 1930s, she played a maid or a cook in nearly 40 films, which brought criticism from Black groups. "Why should I complain about making $700 a week playing a maid?" McDaniel asked. "If I didn't, I'd be making $7 a week actually being one." After World War II, the NAACP and other liberal Black groups lobbied Hollywood for an end to the stereotype roles in which McDaniel had become typecast. Her Hollywood opportunities declined. In 1947, McDaniel became the first Black to star in a weekly radio program aimed at a general audience when she agreed to play a maid on The Beulah Show. In 1951, while filming a TV version of the popular Beulah Show, McDaniel had a heart attack. She recovered sufficiently to tape a number of radio shows in 1952, but died soon thereafter of breast cancer. There is one chart that goes along with this story. It is a list of all Black Oscar winners. In the history of the Academy Awards, 22 performances by Black actors or actresses have won Oscars. Here's the list. Best Actor: Sidney Poitier, Lilies of the Field in 1963, Denzel Washington, Training Day, 2001. Jamie Foxx for Ray in 2004. Forrest Whitaker, The Last King of Scotland in 2006. Will Smith for King Richard, 2021. In the Best Actress category, Halle Berry won in Monsters Ball in 2001. Black Oscar winners in the Best Supporting Actor category were Lou Gossett Jr. in An Officer and a Gentleman in 1982, Denzel Washington in Glory in 1989, Cuba Gooding Jr. in Jerry Maguire in 1996, Morgan Freeman in Million Dollar Baby in 2004, Mahershala Ali in Moonlight 2016, Mahershala Ali in Green Book 2018, Daniel Kaluuya in Judas and the Black Messiah 2020. Black Oscar winners in the Best Supporting Actress category were Hattie McDaniel with Gone with the Wind in 1939, Whoopi Goldberg for Ghost in 1990, Jennifer Hudson in Dreamgirls 2006, Monique in Precious in 2009, Octavia Spencer for her role in The Help in 2011, Lupita Nyong'o for 12 Years a Slave in 2013, Viola Davis for Fences in 2016, Regina King for her role in If Beale Street Could Talk in 2018, and Ariana DeBose for West Side Story in 2021. That was the article titled, The Complicated Legacy of Oscar Winner Hattie McDaniel. It was written by Ernie Suggs and Arlinda Brody and published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper on February 6, 2024. Next on today's African American Hour is a story titled, Black Couple's Kiss is Not Just a Kiss. The subtitle is, Long-Lost Film Broke Stereotypes Depicted Rare Show of Affection. It was written by Ernie Suggs and published February 14, 2024, in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. Against a backdrop of minstrelly shows of the time, which show black people in torn and tattered clothes with bugged-out eyes and grotesque lips, often limited to exaggerated and dehumanizing bestial stereotypes, stood a neatly dressed couple in Victorian-era clothing. Their eyes were locked on each other. Their lips seek affection. And for 20 seconds at least, in a moment lost for more than a century since 1898, there was something good. A recently discovered film clip of a well-dressed black couple swinging in each other's arms in a joyous embrace, laughing, joking, teasing, and most important, kissing, offers one of the earliest cinematic depictions of affection between a black man and woman. The groundbreaking film is called simply Something Good, Negro Kiss. The discovery of the film almost didn't happen. In 2017, Dino Everett, a film archivist at the University of Southern California's HMH Moving Image Archive, was digging through old nitrate reels when he came upon one that a Louisiana collector sent him 3 years earlier. Most random reels that archivists are sent have no historical or cinematic value. But when Everett looked and saw a joyful black couple kissing, he knew he had something special. I went to class that night and told my students, I don't know what this is yet, but I am pretty sure that this is the most important film in my catalog, Everett said. For verification, Everett sent a note and a still of the film to Allison Nadia Field, an associate professor of film and media studies at the University of Chicago, who specializes in the intersection of race and cinema. Yes, it was very important, said Field, the author of Uplift Cinema, The Emergence of African American Film and the Possibility of Black Modernity. It was like something I've never seen before. We were looking at something quite remarkable and something that we didn't think could have been made at the time that it was made and that we didn't think existed. As early as 1894, according to the Library of Congress, short anthropological pieces depicting black people were made but did not show intimacy or humanity. Field and Everett did some research through inventory and distribution catalogs and found that the film they discovered was made by William Selleck, a white Chicago-based American filmmaker who shot films in the late 1800s and early 1900s. Something Good, Negro Kiss, was always listed on inventories, but because it was lost, scholars like Field and Everett assumed it contained the same kind of stereotypical images from films like Thomas Edison's Watermelon Eating Contest, 1896, or Who Said Chicken, 1900. Early cinema is egregious for this and replete with all kinds of stereotypes, Field said. So we see images like Watermelon Eating Contest or gags where a mother is trying to wash the skin color off the baby. Those were our early images of black people that we were used to seeing, those racist stereotypes. Something Good, Negro Kiss, starred noted vaudeville performers Saint Subtle and Gertie Brown, who were members of the Ragtime Four, a vaudeville quartet out of Chicago. After shooting the film, Subtle continued to perform and write music until he died in 1932. Brown went on to marry Tim Moore of Amos and Andy fame, and the two toured the country as Tim and Gertie Moore. She died in 1934 of double pneumonia. Field, who was writing a book about the rediscovery of the film, said Subtle and Brown were likely hired to cakewalk in the film and were later encouraged to kiss. They surmised it might have been a response to the 1896 film, The May Irwin Kiss, one of the first films ever shown commercially to the public. Something Good, Negro Kiss, was likely shown to white audiences as a comedic short alongside films that depicted stereotypical blacks or whites in blackface. Field is unclear on what the reception was or if the showing of love and intimacy had a cultural impact on the thinking of the time, as such scenes are generally not shown in white-dominated settings. Everett said that when he watched the film, he kept waiting for a punchline, a joke. So for this to exist of just two black people being joyful and exhibiting love is unique. This is not like any other film, Everett said. When the University of Southern California School of Cinematic Arts released the film online in 2018, it immediately went viral. Noted black actress Viola Davis said simply, "Love, love, love this. Hashtag black love. We're not crying. You are." In 2021, following the attention and buzz, a different unidentified extended cut, which had been sitting in the National Library of Norway for decades, surfaced. About 30 seconds longer and shot at a wider angle, the extended cut, which might have been made for an international audience, shows an even more playful Subtle and Brown, who ended the shot with a dramatic twirl in addition to the kiss. According to the National Film Preservation Board, fewer than 20% of American films made during the silent era survive in complete form. Taking it a step further, Martin Scorsese's Film Foundation estimates that more than half of all American films made before 1950 are lost. The data does not indicate the race of the filmmakers or the stars, but it is assumed that black or race films suffered tremendous loss. Take Oscar Michaud, one of the first and most prominent black filmmakers of his time, known for films such as Within Our Gates and The Symbol of the Unconquered. Michaud's very first film, The Homesteader, is lost, as are The Brute, 1920, The Gonzales Mystery, 1921, Birthright, 1924, The House Behind the Cedars, 1924, The Conjure Woman, 1926, The Spider's Web, 1927, and The Wages of Sin, 1928, which makes the discovery of Something Good, Negro Kiss, all the more remarkable. Since its rediscovery, several artists and creatives have reinterpreted it. In January, Grammy Award-winning tenor saxophonist Kebby Williams and director-choreographer T. Lang put together a musical and dance tribute called Black Kiss, Still Good. Marking Williams' 50th birthday, it was 60 minutes of slow movements and gestures against a sensuous score. I crave wanting to see simplicity and mundane and peaceful and caring and deliberate tenderness of black love that puts it right in your face. I want to see more of that type of pleasure, expressions, and representations. And folks in 1898 were wanting to see that too. In 2018, Something Good, Negro Kiss, was added to the Library of Congress's National Film Registry as a film deemed culturally significant. That was the article titled, Black Couples Kiss, Not Just a Kiss. Long-lost film broke stereotypes, depicted rare show of affection. It was written by Ernie Suggs and published February 14, 2024 in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Next on today's African American Hour is an opinion piece from the website TheHill.com. The title is, Why Black Americans Should Commemorate the History of Liberia. It was written by Roger House and published February 11, 2024. The Republic of Liberia was controversial when founded by free black immigrants from America during the darkest days of slavery. Today, it stands as a symbol of a successful colonial experiment by African Americans. Yet the country holds little sway in the U.S. public imagination today, a neglect that needs correction during Black History Month. And all the more so during an election year when politicians neglect history for advantage. The history of Liberia should be honored as much as the Independence Holiday of Juneteenth, and the Congressional Black Caucus and Library of Congress should include it in commemorations. Black tourists seeking to connect with the African past should consider it as well. Many tend to visit countries like Senegal or Ghana, and pay homage to historical landmarks of imprisonment like Goree Island and Elmina Castle. Yet, when one experiences the community's long experience with incarceration and the physical and psychological trauma therein, why travel so far to touch base with something so familiar at home? And especially when there is an alternative with a far more inspiring backstory directly connected to their past. This is the land of liberty known as Liberia, set on the west coast of Africa at the bend of the Gulf of Guinea. It was the second black republic after Haiti, founded two centuries ago by free people as most of their peers were in chains. The region that became Liberia was long known by European traders as the Grain Coast for its agricultural products. That distinction vanished when the demand for slaves made selling people more lucrative than selling pepper. The Liberia Project was controversial within the small and hard-pressed community of free black people, which comprised about 10% of the African population of around 500,000 in the antebellum period. One reason for suspicion was the promotion by white power brokers of the American Colonization Society, ACS, founded in 1817. The group included prominent figures such as Henry Clay, the senator from Kentucky, and John Randolph, a congressman from Virginia. They endorsed a relocation project for free blacks interested in a new start. These white supporters wanted to cull the free population as it expanded after the Revolutionary War, in part as a result of the emancipations of some 5,000 black soldiers who fought alongside the Americans against the British. The question of immigration became a major topic of discussion in black conventions throughout the early 19th century. Most objected to the idea as a scheme to rid the land of people best positioned to challenge the perpetuation of slavery. They also argued that after 200 years of sacrifice in labor and blood, they were entitled to citizenship and a piece of the turf. Supporters of the project, always a minority viewpoint, argued that life was too short to wait on citizenship and the end of slavery. Whatever the motives of the ACS, they viewed it as an opportunity to pioneer a new life away from the slavocracy of America. So, like the pilgrims who fled religious persecution in 1620, a group of free blacks fled racial subjugation in 1820. And like the pilgrims, they encountered years of hardship, hunger, disease, and death, but they persevered until the colony was stable. By 1824, they began a gradual procession of separation from the ACS. They drafted a constitution and formed a government, and unlike the United States, their constitution forbade slavery and participation in the slave trade. The largest settlement was named Monrovia in honor of President James Monroe, and the unification of several settlements became Liberia. Who were some of the early settlers to establish the first African republic? There was Lot Carey, one of the founders of Monrovia. Born into slavery in Virginia, he organized the Richmond African Baptist Missionary and immigrated to Liberia with members of the mission in 1821. He organized a native workforce for export crops, established a trade company, and was appointed governor of Monrovia in 1828. And there was John Russworm, only the third free black person to graduate from an American college, Baldwin College in Maine. In 1827, he co-founded the Freedom's Journal in New York, believed to be the first black-owned newspaper. He went to Liberia as the colonial secretary for the ACS in 1830. There, he established the first Western-style newspaper in Africa, the Liberia Herald, and was appointed governor of the Maryland settlement. No one was as important as James Jenkins Roberts, the first president of the republic. In 1829, Roberts immigrated from Virginia at 20 years of age, becoming a merchant and aide to the white governor of the colony. In 1842, he was appointed the first black governor of Liberia with an agenda to cut ties with the ACS. On July 26, 1847, Liberia declared its independence to the world. Roberts was elected president and negotiated peace treaties with indigenous nations, ending a series of tit-for-tat skirmishes. The new republic was recognized by Britain, France, Portugal, Austria, Norway, Denmark, Sweden, and Haiti. The U.S. dragged its feet until 1862 when President Lincoln recognized it during the Civil War, no doubt with an eye on the growing number of slaves abandoning plantations. Liberia drew the attention of thousands of blacks with skills and education in the second half of the century. One was Edward Wilmot Blyden. Born in the U.S. Virgin Islands in 1832 and living in the United States around 1850. He went to Liberia to teach high school and flourished under the freedom of the black state. He became a Renaissance man teaching theology, the classics, geography, and mathematics. He authored 5 books including African Life and Customs, a pioneering work on tribal anthropology. After the Civil War, Blyden, then Secretary of State and professor of classics at Liberia College, returned to the United States to recruit others, attracting a final wave of settlers after the disappointment of the Reconstruction experience. Today, Liberia is a stable constitutional republic of 5.5 million people and one of only 2 African states, along with Ethiopia, to avoid European colonization. It was an ally of the United States during World War II, providing the critical commodity of rubber. After suffering 2 civil wars in the late 20th century, it bounced back in 2006 under President Ellen Sirleaf, the first woman elected to head an African state, and the recipient of the 2011 Nobel Peace Prize. What is important for Black History Month is their appreciation of the daring shown by the early pioneers, how they dreamed of building a free and prosperous state during the time of slavery, how they embarked on that dream, and how the dream might be applied in black communities today. That was the opinion piece titled, Why Black Americans Should Commemorate the History of Liberia. It was written by Roger House and published February 11th, 2024, at the website thehill.com. My next reading on today's African American Hour is an opinion piece from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. The title is, Black Athletes Have Chance to Send Message. It was written by Kelvin B. Blackstone and published March 18, 2024. The subtitle to the story is, Staying Away from Schools in States That Have Enacted Policies Against DEI Would Be an Apt Protest. The story was told to me more than 30 years ago in a small Texas church where I joined regular folk and former NFL stars at the funeral of Willie Ray Smith, Sr. It was said that Smith, a legendary Texas high school football coach, had for a decade refused to let his players go to white Southern college football teams after they acceded to suit up black players. Instead, he continued to steer his best players north, particularly to Michigan State, where his middle son, future NFL Pro Bowl defensive lineman and actor Bubba, helped the Spartans win a national championship. It was a protest born as a sort of athletic underground railroad, as sports writer Tom Shanahan accurately described it, referencing the escape route north for enslaved Africans in the antebellum South. Because for more than a generation in which Smith coached, Those Southern schools for which his sons and the sons of other black families dreamed of playing didn't believe in diversity, equity, or inclusion. It was as if such policies of fairness were toxic and had no place in the South's public universities, which is how Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, a Republican, described diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. This was after the University of Florida announced last week the sacking of all things DEI, something for which the reactionary governor has been clamoring. Last year, DeSantis signed a bill prohibiting the use of state funds for any DEI programs. "I'm glad that Florida was the first state to eliminate DEI," DeSantis wrote last week, "and I hope more states will follow." It was enough to spur Emmitt Smith, the Pro Football Hall of Fame running back, who is arguably the greatest football player in the history of Florida's flagship institution of higher learning, to respond to DeSantis that he was utterly disgusted by the University of Florida's decision and the precedent that it sets. "We cannot continue to believe and trust that a team of leaders all made up of the same background will make the right decision when it comes to equality and diversity. History has already proved that is not the case. We need diverse thinking and backgrounds to enhance our university, and the DEI department is necessary to accomplish those goals." To the many minority athletes at UF, Smith continued, "Please be aware and vocal about this decision by the university, who is now closing doors on other minorities without any oversight." Smith, whom I've never known as a particularly remonstrative person, didn't conclude with a plan of action. But his message alluded to one. It's the same that Willie Ray Smith Sr. took against such intolerant action decades ago. Black coaches and every black parent or guardian of a black college football or basketball recruit can let wishful college coaches know that those boys to men aren't going to work, which is what playing college sports is, at places where people of color, women, and other marginalized folks are not otherwise supported. Young black athletes can go elsewhere rather than those Southern state universities that are moving to mimic the days they refused Willie Ray Smith Sr.'s graduates. The same goes for Northern states that are implementing policies no different. Then, let any governor or state legislative body defend their retrograde decision-making to coaches who start losing recruits and to university officials who witness waning revenue as a result. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People on Monday even suggested black college athletes consider boycotting predominantly white schools in Florida. After all, Florida's athletic department made more than $190 million during its 2022 fiscal year, the most recent public financial reporting period detailed by an annual USA Today sports analysis of the most lucrative college athletic programs. Only 7 schools earned more. In the previous 2 fiscal years, football accounted for 47% and 53% of annual athletic revenue, the school said, while men's basketball comprised 10% and 7% respectively. And who disproportionately predominated Florida's football and basketball rosters? Young black men. In fact, when the University of Southern California professor Sean Harper last updated the study of black male athletes at Power 5 conferences in 2018, he found black male athletes were more overrepresented at Florida than any other school. Black men were 2.2% of undergraduates at Florida, he found, but comprised 77.7% of football and men's basketball teams. In short, Florida didn't really have much use for young black men unless they were playing revenue-generating sports. It's safe to say not much has changed. Florida isn't alone in this discrepancy of dependency on young black men, but those Southern schools that for so long dismissed Willie Ray Smith's players, especially those with Florida in the SEC, led the way. Smith was coach at 3 segregated Texas high schools, most famously Charlton, Pollard, and Beaumont, from 1957 to 75. Smith won 235 games, won 2 state black school championships, and sent more than 20 players to the pros on his railroad out of the South. But schools like the University of Texas, where Bubba longed to play, weren't having black players then. DeSantis' equally reactionary Republican gubernatorial peer, Texas's Greg Abbott, last summer signed into law a bill similar to Florida's, outlawing DEI at Texas colleges and universities. The impact that parents and guardians of black recruits could have on state schools so dependent upon the labor of their children by avoiding places with regressive racial rules like DeSantis's Florida would be immeasurable. It'd be like the opening scene that makes for one of my favorite plays, Douglas Turner Ward's brilliant satire on Southern racism, Day of Absence, from 1965. Just about the time Southern schools started wising up the benefits of no longer discriminating against black athletes. A stereotypical Southern town of the time wakes up to find that all its black folks have disappeared. Chaos ensues. There's no one to take care of the babies, cook the food, wash the clothes. The town is paralyzed without its black labor force. That's the kind of pain young black men could affect on states and schools threatening to turn back the clock. Just find Willie Ray Smith Sr.'s footsteps and walk in them. That was the opinion piece, Black Athletes Have Chance to Send Message. It was written by Kevin Blackstone and published March 18, 2024, in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. My next reading on today's African American Hour is an obituary from the New York Times newspaper. The title is, Louis Gossett Jr., 87, Dies, an Officer and a Gentleman and Roots Actor. It was written by Anita Gates and published March 29, 2024. The subtitle to the obituary is, His portrayal of a drill instructor earned him the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. He was the first black performer to win in that category. Louis Gossett Jr., who took home an Academy Award for An Officer and a Gentleman and an Emmy for Roots, both times playing a mature man who guides a younger one taking on a new role, but in drastically different circumstances, died early Friday, March 29th, in Santa Monica, California. He was 87. Mr. Gossett's first cousin, Neil L. Gossett, confirmed the death. He did not specify a cause. Mr. Gossett was 46 when he played Emil Foley, the Marine drill instructor from hell who ultimately shapes the humanity of an emotionally damaged young naval aviation recruit, Richard Gere, in An Officer and a Gentleman, from 1982. Reviewing the movie in the New York Times, Vincent Canby described Sergeant Foley as a cruel taskmaster, recycled as a man of recognizable cunning, dedication, and humor, revealed in the kind of performance that wins awards. Mr. Gossett told the Times that he had recognized the role's worth immediately. The words just tasted good, he recalled. When he accepted the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor in 1983, he was the first black performer to win in that category, and only the third, after Hattie McDaniel and Sidney Poitier, to win an Academy Award for acting. Mr. Gossett, a versatile actor, played a range of parts in his long career, but he was best known for playing decent, plain-spoken men, often authority figures. By the time he won his Oscar, he had already won an Emmy as Fiddler, the mentor of the lead character Kunta Kinte, played by LeVar Burton, in the blockbuster 1977 miniseries Roots. Fiddler was, as the name suggested, a musician, an enslaved man on an 18th century Virginia plantation. Mr. Gossett was not thrilled about the role at first. Why choose me to play the Uncle Tom, he remembered thinking in a 2018 Television Academy video interview. But he came to admire the survival skills of forebears like Fiddler, he said, and based the character on his grandparents and a great-grandmother. That portrayal, he said, became a tribute to all those people who taught me how to behave. Louis Cameron Gossett Jr. was born on May 27, 1936 in Brooklyn, the only child of Louis Gossett, a porter, and Helen Ray Gossett, a nurse. He made his Broadway debut when he was 17 and still a student at Abraham Lincoln High School on Ocean Parkway. While healing after a basketball injury, he appeared in a school play just to occupy his time. Impressed, a teacher suggested that he audition for Take a Giant Step, a play by Louis Peterson that was opening at the Lyceum Theater in the fall of 1953. He won the lead role, that of Spencer Scott, a troubled adolescent. Brooks Atkinson of the Times praised his admirable and winning performance, one that conveyed the whole range of Spencer's turbulence. Sidney Fields devoted a column in the Sunday Mirror to the young man who shared his career plans. "I always wanted to study pharmacy," Mr. Gossett said. "But now after college, I'll try acting. I know it's a tough business, but if I fail, I'll have the pharmacy degree to fall back on." He ended up majoring in drama and minoring in pharmacy while on a basketball scholarship at New York University. In 1955, he returned to Broadway in William Merchant's comedy, The Desk Set. By the time he graduated, acting was paying him more than any basketball team would. He made his film debut as an annoying college man in A Raisin in the Sun in 1961, an adaptation of the Lorraine Hansberry play that starred Sidney Poitier and Ruby Dee. He had appeared on screen only twice before, in two episodes of The Big Story, an NBC drama series, in 1957 and 1958. Before becoming a film star, Mr. Gossett had a thriving theater career. In less than a decade, he landed six Broadway roles, including that of a Harlem hustler in Tambourines to Glory, 1963, a South African grandfather's servant in The Zulu and the Zeta, 1965, a lawyer who killed a white man in a civil rights demonstration in My Sweet Charlie, 1966, and the Congolese leader Patrice Lumumba in Dangerous Angels from 1971. In the mid-1960s, he replaced the actor playing the big-time boxing promoter Eddie Satin in the musical Golden Boy, starring Sammy Davis Jr. His most unfortunate role may have been as a black man with a white slave in Carry Me Back to Morningside Heights in 1968, a comedy written by Robert Allen Author and directed by Sidney Poitier. The play, which Clive Barnes of the Times called racist, closed after a week. Mr. Gossett never committed to another Broadway role, but he appeared for four nights as the flashy lawyer Billy Finn in the musical Chicago in 2002. His dozens of feature films included The Landlord, 1970, in which he played a man on the brink of insanity, Travels with My Aunt, 1972, and The Deep, 1977, as a Bahamian drug dealer. His later films included Digstown of 1992, in which he played a boxer, and the movie version of Sam Shepard's Curse of the Starving Class, 1994, in which he played a bar owner. Mr. Gossett made more than 100 television appearances, ranging from lighthearted comedies like The Partridge Family to dramas like Madam Secretary. He played the title role, a Columbia anthropology professor who investigates crimes, on the short-lived 1989 series Gideon Oliver. He also appeared in numerous television movies, among them The Lazarus Syndrome, 1978, about a cardiologist, A Gathering of Old Men, 1987, about a black man who kills in self-defense, Strange Justice, 1999, about the Clarence Thomas Supreme Court confirmation process. He played the presidential advisor Vernon Jordan, and Lackawanna Blues, 2005, based on Ruben Santiago Hudson's play. His other TV movie roles included the Egyptian leader Anwar Sadat and the baseball star Satchel Paige. He continued to act until last year, when he was seen in the film version of the Broadway musical The Color Purple. Mr. Gossett's marriage to Haiti Glasgow in 1964 lasted only 5 months. He and Christina Mangelsing married in 1973, had one child, and divorced after 2 years. His 1987 marriage to Cindy James Reese ended in divorce in 1992. Mr. Gossett is survived by his sons, Sadie and Sharon Gossett, and several grandchildren. In the Television Academy interview, Mr. Gossett urged fellow actors to help effect political and social change in a disturbing world. "The arts can achieve it overnight," he said. "Millions of people are watching." He added, "We can get to them quicker than anybody else." That was the obituary titled, "Louis Gossett Jr., 87, Dies, an Officer and a Gentleman and Roots Actor." It was written by Anita Gates and published March 29, 2024, in the New York Times, nytimes.com website. Next on today's African American Hour is an essay from The Atlantic magazine. The title is "The Black Box of Race," written by Henry Louis Gates and published March 16th, 2024. The subtitle to the article is, In a Circumscribed Universe, Black Americans Have Ceaselessly Reinvented Themselves. My daughter Maggie gave birth to Ellie, my granddaughter, by C-section on a Saturday afternoon in November 2014. That evening, my son-in-law, Aaron, came over for a warm hug and a celebratory shot of bourbon. I listened to Aaron's play-by-play of the events, and after a decent pause, I asked the question that I had wanted to ask all along. Did you check the box? Without missing a beat, my good son-in-law responded, Yes, sir, I did. Very good, I responded, as I poured a second shot. Aaron, a young white man, had checked the black box on the form that Americans are required to complete at the time of the birth of a child. Now my daughter's father's admixture, in other words mine, is 50% sub-Saharan African and 50% European, according to DNA tests. My son-in-law is 100% European. Because Maggie is 75% European, Ellie will test about 87.5% European when she spits in the test tube. Eleanor Margaret Gates Hatley, who looks like an adorable little white girl, will live her life as a black person because her father and mother checked the black box. That choice will define so many of Ellie's encounters with the world, from how her college application is read to how her physician assesses her risk for certain medical conditions. And she will be destined, throughout her life, to face the challenge of proving that she is black, simply because her self-styled race man grandfather ardently, and perhaps foolishly, wished for her racial self to be socially constructed that way. Such is the absurdity of the history of race and racial designations in the United States, stemming from the law of hypodescent, the proverbial one-drop rule. Perhaps Eleanor will choose to dance the dance of racial indeterminacy, moving effortlessly back and forth across the color line. Or maybe she will claim a social identity that reflects her European identity. Or maybe she will keep a photograph of her grandfather in her pocketbook and delight in refuting, or affirming, as the case may be, the laughable, tragic arbitrariness of the social construction of race in America. The most important thing is that this be her choice. The black box has become a powerful symbol for me. In the event of a plane crash, of course, the black box is what survives. A record of the truth amid disastrous circumstances. The black box is something you can't see inside. It has inputs and outputs, but its internal workings are not comprehensible. Above all, it is a metaphor for the circumscribed universe within which people of African descent have been forced to construct a new identity on this side of the Atlantic. The Yale legal scholar Stephen L. Carter defined his own box in this way. To be black and an intellectual in America is to live in a box. So, I live in a box, not of my own making, and on the box is a label, not of my own choosing. Most of those who have not met me, and many of those who have, see the box and read the label and imagine they have seen me. In Carter's usage, the black box is a place of identity confinement through predefinition, akin to the late literary critic Barbara Johnson's definition of stereotype as an already read text. The black face enters the room, and at a glimpse, the viewer knows all they need to know about the person wearing the mask of blackness. Good luck, Carter is suggesting, shedding any of those connotations. And yet, a great proportion of the history of African Americans consists of the marvelous and ingenious means by which they have navigated their way in and out of the box in which they've been confined. Perhaps the first black box was the definition of Africa as the dark continent, a metaphor for the color of its inhabitants' skin, as well as for their supposed benightedness. This metaphor was used to justify the second, even crueler black box, within which people of African descent found themselves placed by Europeans. The dreadful transatlantic slave trade, responsible for perhaps the largest forced migration in human history. It was the repository of all the racist stereotypes employed to justify the enslavement of a continent of human beings and then, subsequent to the abolition of slavery, to justify the rollback of Reconstruction and the rise of Jim Crow segregation. The author Henry Box Brown literalized this trope by escaping from slavery in 1849 by being shipped from Richmond to Philadelphia in a box measuring 3 feet, 1 inch long, 2 feet 6 inches high and 2 feet wide. The box was labeled this side up to keep Brown upright. But the instruction was often ignored, meaning Brown spent hours of his trip upside down, drinking water from a beef bladder and breathing through 3 drilled holes. But the black box was always, somehow, a place of creativity, a universe of culture mysteriously and inexplicably produced and often unintelligible to those outside it. Frederick Douglass recognized this when he mused about the sorrow songs, spirituals composed by enslaved men and women. They would make the dense old woods for miles around reverberate with their wild songs, revealing at once the highest joy and the deepest sadness. These songs were composed in code, music set to words which to many would seem unmeaning jargon, but which nevertheless were full of meaning to themselves. Douglass himself confessed he did not understand. They told a tale of woe which was then altogether beyond my feeble comprehension. In 1884, this magazine published a long article called The Negro Problem by the Harvard professor Nathaniel Shaler, a paleontologist and geologist as well as a strong proponent of scientific racism and eugenics. Shaler's white supremacist discourse fell squarely into the school of thought imposed on the black community that was used well into the 20th century to justify the eradication of rights gained by African Americans during Reconstruction. 13 years later, also in this magazine, W.E.B. Du Bois wrote, "Being a problem is a strange experience." His essay, Strivings of the Negro People, which he would revise slightly for his 1903 book, The Souls of Black Folk, described the Negro problem labeled as a kind of black box. "The shades of the prison house closed round us all, walls straight and stubborn to the whitest, but relentlessly narrow, tall, and unscalable to sons of night who must plod darkly against the stone or steadily, half hopelessly watch the streak of blue above." The writers of these two Atlantic essays knew each other. Shaler was Du Bois' professor at Harvard. Perhaps paradoxically, Du Bois expressed gratitude to Shaler for defending his presence in class against the protest of a Southern student. It was to free himself and the race from the bounds of this box that Du Bois and many others wrote and spoke so prolifically, addressing the subject again and again. For Ralph Ellison in Invisible Man, the black box is both a boxing ring in which 2 blindfolded black boys are forced to beat each other senseless, and also the hole in which Ellison's protagonist hides from the world that seeks to impose upon him its mask of identity, where he types the manuscript that we eventually are supposed to learn we are reading over his shoulder. But being doomed to fight against racism could also be a trap. As Du Bois' fellow Harvard graduate and sometimes ideological foe, the philosopher Alan Locke put it, "Even the thinking Negro, inside a black box forged in the mind of America, is forced to see himself in the distorted perspective of a social problem. His shadow, so to speak, has been more real to him than his personality." More recently, Terence Hayes's poem, The Black Seuss, explores the metaphor of the black box. It begins, "Blacks in one box, blacks in two box, blacks on, blacks stacked in boxes, stacked on boxes, blacks in boxes, stacked on shores, blacks in boxes, stacked on boats in darkness, blacks in boxes do not float, blacks in boxes count their losses." And ends, "Blacks in voting booths are blacks in boxes. Blacks beside blacks in rows of houses are blacks in boxes too." As a professor, I try to teach my students about how black people have sought to escape from this box. But even more important, I endeavor to expose them to the long tradition of black discourse and the often disregarded fact that black people have been arguing with one another about what it means to be black since they began to publish their thoughts and feelings in the latter quarter of the 18th century. When Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had the audacity to insert himself into the morality of American involvement in the Vietnam War, for example, even, or especially, several of his fellow leaders of the civil rights movement told him that he was out of bounds, demanding that he redirect his concerns to issues relevant to those doomed to dwell within the black box, advice that the good Reverend boldly ignored. The moral is that there never has been one way to be black, that African Americans are as varied and as complex as their political and religious beliefs as any other group, and they have voiced those internal differences with great fervor and passion, stunning eloquence and vehemence, often even subjecting those black thinkers with whom they disagree to the nastiest and pettiest ad hominem attacks. These debates within and about the African American tradition have for too long been opaque to most Americans, in the way that the songs of his enslaved sisters and brothers remain opaque to Frederick Douglass. Too often we talk about the black community as if it were a village composed of a unitary group, one with shared experiences and unified views. Reflecting on what binds black Americans together and on what distinguishes individuals and subcultures within that tradition has never been more crucial than at this contested and polarized moment. With its focus on identity and identity politics and Americans' lazy predisposition to think of every group as monolithic. But the tradition of black thought is most correctly described as a series of contentions, many of them fiery ones. And fire, as the greatest black intellectuals have always known, can generate light as well as heat. The right answer about how to escape the black box has never been formulated, precisely because there never has been and never will be one right answer to that haunting question. Consider this paradox. The very concept of race is the child of racism. Blackness was an arbitrary category invented by Europeans and Americans in the Enlightenment to justify the horror show of black subjugation. The human beings who suddenly became black were then forced to play a complex game of representation to claim some space in the world, and that vexed process evolved into a rich legacy of self-definition within this diverse community composed of every type of person living on the planet Earth. Some 50 million of them in this country alone, connected to their relationship to this proverbial black box, a metaphysical construct invented to justify an economic order in which their selfhood could be objectified, their subjectivity robbed, and their labor stolen. They created this legacy of self-definition in no small part by using the master's tool, writing. During the Enlightenment, black authors such as Ignatius Sancho, John Morant, and Olalla Equiano managed to forge successful careers against all the odds. Others were less fortunate. Despite her unprecedented fame, the poet Phyllis Wheatley died in obscurity and poverty in 1784. Jacques Capitaine, a formerly enslaved man from the Gold Coast, defended his doctoral dissertation, which he argued that the Bible did not oppose slavery, at the University of Leiden in 1742. He returned home, founded a school, and, after falling from Dutch grace, was buried in an unmarked grave. We can begin to understand how he was seen by his contemporaries through the words a fellow student at Leiden inscribed in the foreword to Capitaine's dissertation. "See this Moor? His skin is black, but white is his soul. He will bring faith, hope, and love to the Africans, so they will, whiten, honor the Lamb." The small elite group of black intellectuals wrote very few words about the matter of their blackness in a world still wrestling with who and what they were, and what the relation between blackness and whiteness could possibly be in European economies, defined by the trade in black human beings. No matter how brilliant an individual of color might be, no matter how much fame, respect, or financial success he might achieve, he was standing on a trap door. Thus was the fate of Angelo Solomon. Solomon was born around 1721, likely in what is now Nigeria. According to the scholars Iris Wigger and Spencer Hadley, he was stolen from his family as a child and forced into slavery in Italy, where he became the property of the imperial governor of Sicily, Count Lobkowitz. When the count died, Solomon became a servant to a prince in Vienna, dressed in exotic styles as a so-called court Moor. The prince dismissed Solomon when, without permission, he married an aristocratic widow. Nevertheless, Solomon's stature only increased, and his black box began to crack open. He continued to move in aristocratic circles, rejoined the royal court as an educator under the prince's successor, and joined a Masonic lodge that counted Mozart and Haydn among its members. Solomon became the grand master of this lodge and gave its rituals a more scholarly bent, so much so that he is still celebrated in Masonic lore as Angelus Solomonus, the father of pure Masonic thought. He spoke multiple languages. He may well have been the most prominent black person in Europe at the time. In death, none of this mattered. Solomon died on November 21, 1796. Despite the pleas of his daughter Josephine, Solomon did not receive a proper Christian burial. Instead, his body fell into the hands of the director of the Royal Natural History Collection, Abi Eberle, who had hatched his heinous plan while Solomon was still alive, petitioning the government for the cession of the corpse. What followed was horrific. As Wigram Hatley wrote, Eberle ordered a death mask to be created before Solomon's skin was removed and prepared for exhibition with a stuffing compound. The so-created figure was then dressed up as a savage in a loincloth with an ostrich feather crown and glass beads, and presented to the public in the midst of taxidermized exotic animals. In the ultimate humiliation, Solomon was placed on display at the museum, a debased artifact trapped behind a glass. As late as 1806, this perverse specter of European primitivism and anti-black racism was still proudly on display, a literal realization of permanent suspension in a black box. Eventually, it was moved to a warehouse, which burned in the October Revolution of 1848. The quest for culture and individual identity in the fate of such history is an argument without end. Like all truly great arguments, it is a story of ceaseless creativity and reinvention, without which any attempt to understand America is not just incomplete, but absurd. That was the essay titled The Black Box of Race, written by Henry Louis Gates, Jr., and published March 16, 2024, in The Atlantic Magazine. Additionally, the essay was adapted from the forthcoming book, The Black Box, Writing the Race. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to listen to this program again or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcast or at the Audio Reader website at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.